We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning.
No job this morning. He's taking the week off.
Yes. All right. We're going to start out with continuing on the endorsements. We started that last week.
Yes. Yes. I just want to remind everybody that August 6th is the day you have to mail in your ballot. That's next Tuesday. So this weekend, you better sit down
it's
and fill
coming
it out.
Up.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about the mayoral endorsements because I know Jav couldn't actually talk about the mayoral endorsements.
He did
last
actually
week.
A bit.
Did he?
But with a few minutes explaining why.
Explaining why he shouldn't. But yeah. And if you go to our website, you'll see a list of our endorsements there on eattheState.org. On the Eat the State website, we have a dual endorsement for Joey Gray and for Peter Steinbrück. However, I wanted to talk a little bit about my reasoning for who I would personally endorse in the mayor's race. I don't actually agree with the endorsement that we have up on the website. I think Joey Gray doesn't have a chance. She's a latecomer to the race. She's a good candidate, but I don't think she has a chance to make it through to the general. And given that Peter Steinbrück has a real shot at it, I think folks should be looking more seriously at voting for him. Now, I also want to talk about the other three front runners in the race, too, because in this race, it's unusual, but that's the nature of Seattle politics, that you're going to have a Democrat or a left-leaning candidate be most of the major candidates in your city races. In the mayor's race, you have four candidates, each with their own progressive credentials. But also each one of them has at least one drawback. And I want to talk a little bit about each of the four main candidates. First, Mike McGinn, who is the incumbent. His progressive credentials really rely on his background as an environmentalist. He's had one term as mayor. He had no experience coming into the mayor's office, so he's had to get up to speed, and that's been a difficult thing for him to do. And you have to ask at this point, what has he really done as mayor of the city for the last 3.5 years? And most people, the most they can come up with is, well, yeah, he's put in a bunch of bike lanes and he's instituted a bunch of road diets. But he's had a lot of problems as mayor of the city, in particular resisting police reforms. He's had trouble working with the city council on just about anything. He's been ardently pro-developer. All we have to do is look at the South Lake Union rezone in order to see that he's in the habit of looking at the developer's proposal for a rezone and making a few little tweaks and then saying, let's go with the rest of this, you know, whereas the city council then has to look at that proposal and say, no, wait a minute. We need to be asking for more affordable housing here. We need to be asking for setbacks. We need, you know. And he hasn't done that. So I find that very interesting. A man with environmentalist credentials can be so pro-development. He's also been very happy with the Mercer Beautification Project, which I think more than anything this year has totally messed up traffic in the city of Seattle, particularly this summer when we've also had other road closures around town, whether it's for a fun run, you know, or whether it's for road maintenance. The little bit of road maintenance that is getting done, it has completely messed up traffic. He also has been pretty lame on city transit. His idea of developing city transit is to put more money into more streetcars, which I'm sorry, that's not really a transportation solution. That's more of a marketing thing for tourists. So, you know, McGinn's had his drawbacks and, in particular, the fact that he hasn't taken seriously the transportation maintenance budget that the city is millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars behind on the transportation maintenance backlog. He's had no experience with state government and federal government, so he hasn't had the contacts and the experience to go to the state legislature and to go to the feds and say, how much money can we get for these things? That's been a major drawback for McGinn. And I think that's the main reason why most of the business community is supporting Ed Murray. Now, Ed Murray is the other front runner, according to the polls, the other front runner in this race. He's had 8 years in the state legislature, most recently as the Senate Democratic leader. And he's also served as the budget chair and also served as the transportation chair. So here's a man with a lot of experience of state government and a lot of experience of things that the city, that big issues, that are big issues for the city, like the city budget and transportation issues, things that Seattle is really struggling with right now. He has, his progressive credentials are that he is backed by the lesbian, gay, bi, transgender and transsexual community for his work on marriage equality. He's also got the support of a lot of unions of most of the Democratic Party. And also he's supported by a lot of pro-transit folks because as transportation chair, he worked pretty hard to get more money for sound transit and for local transit districts like King County Metro. Now he's got, as I said, he's got a pretty good track record on transit funding. However, he's also taken a lot of money, as I said before, from the business community. So you look at him and you go, well, here's somebody who I think could get some work done on some of these big issues for the city of Seattle. On the other hand, is it worth voting for someone who's going to owe a debt of gratitude to the business community and is likely to be pro-developer? So there's that drawback when it comes to Murray. So, you know, keep that in mind when you're thinking about who to vote for. Now, the other two candidates who have a shot, who are not front runners, but are close enough that they could squeak through into the general, are Bruce Harrell and Peter Steinbrück. Bruce Harrell, he's a current city council member, and he has the support of communities of color and some labor unions, but he is really struggling to run an effective campaign, and his campaign seems scattershot and very chaotic at times. I think really that's a reflection not just of who's running his campaign, but of the candidate himself. When I've sat in on city council meetings and watched, I've noticed that Harrell is the one member of the city council that has trouble focusing and really listening to testimony that's going on and engaging with the other members of the city council. Seems to me like he has a short attention span, or else he needs to really be multitasking, or else he just feels like he's impatient with the process. And I don't feel that that makes for a good mayor. We've had somebody like Mayor Mike McGinn who's impatient and doesn't like to work with people. I think that's really hampered him, and I don't think we need another person like that in the mayor's office. Now, Peter Steinbrück, on the other hand, he was a former city council member for 10 years as part of a progressive coalition on the council. He's an architect and urban planner, and he's well known for preservation issues in the city of Seattle. He says all the right things. He's for affordable housing, for more open space, for parks and green spaces, for repairing the city's roads, et cetera, et cetera. He has a lot of progressive support. And he has more governmental experience than McGinn did 4 years ago when he became mayor. Steinbrück's also known to be a good listener. He is willing to meet with and discuss issues with all the parties concerned. However, the one drawback that I remember about Peter Steinbrück when he was a city council member is that after hearing from everybody and from all sides, he will often go and do his own thing. So that's another thing you need to take into consideration if you're voting for Peter Steinbrück, is that he does sometimes have the tendency to be a maverick too. So, you may be voting for something that you're not certain, you know, of what you're actually going to be getting. But of the four, I would give a dual endorsement to Murray and Steinbrück. And for me, I think the best of all possible worlds would be to see the two of those make it through to the general election. Although, I think it's going to be Murray and McGinn. I would urge people to vote for Steinbrück. If you're considering Joey Gray versus Peter Steinbrück, I would urge you to vote for Steinbrück.
Listener writes in that Murray has been in the legislature for longer than 8 years. I just looked it up. According to his website, he's been there since 1995. So,
oh yeah, I don't recall where I got the 8 years from, okay. But yeah, it is 1995 is correct.
Yeah,
I
sounds
remember.
Closer to 18 than 8.
Okay,
so on to the you also had a disagreement with the endorsements for the port
for the Port of Seattle commissioner position number 3. Yeah, ETH the state and our endorsements, we have Stephanie Bowman. I don't actually agree with that endorsement. Stephanie Bowman used to work for the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. She also worked on a committee to get the Summer Olympics here, which was an initiative that ETH the State opposed while it was going on. She's also been endorsed by realtors, business groups, and the Seattle Times. She's very slick and she's really good at marketing herself. But you know, I look at her resume and I see that she's never held a job longer than 5 years, which tells me that she's a very ardent self-promoter who's really intent on climbing the ladder as fast as she can. And I really think in a position like port commissioner, where there's a long history of port commissioners sitting down at steak dinners and granting favors to port customers in a sort of you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back kind of way, I think she's the last kind of person we really want in that job. In addition, she's the only candidate in the race who's taken donations from BNSF and SSA Marine, who are both port customers and who have interests in the coal terminal at Cherry Point. Now, among the other two candidates, Andrew Palloud, he's very young, which is nice to see. However, he's also extremely inexperienced, and I was taken aback by his free market libertarian ideas, which I find to be extremely conservative and not a good fit with what I'd like to see in the Port of Seattle. Michael Wolff, on the other hand, while he might initially seem to be the pro-business candidate, he's actually a director of sales at useadeal.com, which is sort of like Groupon, only with better discounts. His experience is as 15 years serving as a travel consultant and a hotel manager, but he's the only candidate who's put forward a progressive platform. He's for infrastructure improvements at the port, but he's also for wage and benefit increases for airport workers who are not unionized, and that includes paid sick leave and health care coverage. Now, remember, airport workers are working in the city of SeaTac, not the city of Seattle, so they're not subject to our paid sick leave rules, so they don't have that benefit. He's also for added security measures to prevent human trafficking, and he's the only candidate who has mentioned the coal trains in his platform. So I find him to be the progressive candidate in this race, and I would support Michael Wolff for the port commissioner position number 3.
All right. So moving on to other news.
Other local news.
Yeah, the State Department of Ecology.
Yeah, they said this week that they're going to do a 2-year environmental study of coal exports through the Cherry Point Terminal, which is near Bellingham. So speaking of coal trains, that's a new development. But the State Department of Ecology hasn't said what the scope of the study is going to be. And we've already been burned on that before, when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said that they would study the impacts of transporting coal through the state of Washington and exporting it through the coal terminal at Cherry Point. And then they went back on it and said, oh, we're not going to study the effects on the broader state environment. We're not going to study the effects on global warming of exporting coal to Asia, which, when you think about it, is really the big issue here, because if approved, Washington state coal terminals would end up shipping 110 million tons of coal to Asia every year, with most of it going through the Cherry Point terminal. And really, in terms of global warming, the U.S. coal market is decreasing year by year, whereas the demand for coal in Asia is skyrocketing. And China has now surpassed the United States in terms of its global warming emissions. That's something that has to be reversed if we're going to save the global climate.
All right. Insurance commissioner coming out with the...
Yeah, the state insurance commissioner announced this week that he has approved, Mike Kreidler, he has approved 31 health insurance plans to be offered on our state health care exchange starting in October 1st. Four companies will be offering those 31 plans. Those four companies are LifeWise, Primera Blue Cross, Bridgespan, and Group Health Cooperative. Three of those companies will also offer plans outside of the exchange, and there are six other companies that are applying to offer plans outside of the exchange. So folks will not have to go through the healthcare exchange in order to find insurance, as the Republicans keep saying. There will be plenty of choice for people, but at the same time, there will also be plenty of choice on the exchange, too, for people who want to go that route to ensure that they're going to get a set level of benefits, a set minimum level of benefits, and not have to try to shop and compare oranges to apples on the private market.
All right. Also out this week, reports about the cracked pontoons.
Oh, yeah. The bill is coming due now for the cracked pontoons on the new 520 bridge. The total is $81.1 million to fix the first half of the pontoons that have been built so far for the new 520 bridge. That eats into the contingency fund, and it's leaving only about $100 million left to cover any other problems that arise and to cover any cost overruns on this $4.1 billion project. That's only a 2.5% buffer. That's a little tiny buffer for problems and cost overruns. Now, remember, of this $4.1 billion project, the state has only funded $2.7 billion. The remaining $1.4 billion is still a question mark. It's supposed to come from tolls or some other, you know, unexplained and unspecified future taxes that the legislature hasn't passed or hasn't discussed yet. So that's something to keep in mind, too. And just to remind people, the cause of the cracking pontoons, those were design errors made by the state engineers who didn't test their pontoon design. What they did was they scaled up the pontoon design for a much smaller floating bridge and decided that, well, if you make them twice as big or however much bigger they were, it's not going to change the stress load on them. Well, that's engineering 101. When you scale up a design, you have to do a test of your design because, yes, stress levels change and stress forces change when you change the dimensions. And of course, the lead engineer on that project was fired earlier this year. So,
all right. Moving on to national, which also touches on local too, but fast food workers.
Yes. This week were more strikes, more fast food worker strikes. Fast food workers continued their one-day strikes for higher wages at restaurants like McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Wendy's. Those strikes went on from here in the city of Seattle to the New York City to St. Louis to lots of places in the Midwest, including Kansas City, Detroit, and even little Flint, Michigan saw some fast food worker strikes. The folks participating in those strikes are asking for an increase in their wages to $15 per hour. Most of them make minimum wage. In Washington state, that's $9.19 per hour. And of course, the average work week for a fast food worker in the United States is only 24 hours per week. So if you take that and multiply that by Washington state's minimum wage, you get less than $11,500 per year to try to house, feed, and clothe yourself, pay for your transportation, to pay for healthcare costs, because, of course, you don't get any benefits as a fast food worker. You don't have health insurance. You have to pay out of pocket for all of your healthcare expenses. It's literally impossible. And a lot of folks who work in the fast food industry work multiple jobs, or they rely on federal benefits like food stamps. So this is good news that they're continuing the strikes, and hopefully it'll have some effect in at least raising the federal minimum wage, which is almost a couple bucks less than our state minimum wage.
Also in other economic news this week?
Yeah, the Obama administration, Barack Obama, announced that he was going to shift his focus away from working on things like immigration reform and on gun control towards working on his economic agenda. And the very first thing he did was rather disappointing, his first announcement, first hard announcement. When it came to his economic agenda, was that he proposed to cut the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 28%. I just looked at that and I said, what? Because, you know, all you have to do is look at the statistics. Corporations are paying less in taxes than they have historically since at least the 1970s. And corporate tax rates have been on the decline since the 1970s. Cutting them further makes absolutely no sense, considering especially since with added loopholes, corporate tax loopholes, a lot of corporations pay much less than the stated 35% rate. Many of them pay in the single digits, and a lot of them pay zero, even though they turn a net profit every year. So in the meantime, Congress, while Obama's talking about cutting corporate tax rates, Congress hasn't passed a bill yet to fund the food stamp program, which is leaving 48 million Americans, that's about 16% of the total population, in limbo in terms of whether or not they'll be able to pay for their meals in the future. House Republicans want to do away with the program altogether, and they were successful at separating it from the agriculture bill, which was a mistake on the Democrats' part to let that actually happen, because now the Republicans can spend forever arguing about it and never pass a bill in the hopes that the program itself will die. Democrats in the Senate have already passed a bill that would cut $4.5 billion from the $80 billion program, while Republicans in the House have proposed a $20.5 billion cut. That's more than 25% of the program. That would kick more than 5 million people off the program altogether. And it would literally force many people to have to choose between paying rent or buying food or buying medicine. And what that means is a lot more homeless people, a lot more people swamping hospital emergency rooms who can't pay their bills. And what it means is a lot of food banks are going to be overwhelmed, because that's where people go when they don't qualify for food stamps. Now, a study also this week, a study by the Associated Press, found that 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or have to rely on welfare for at least a part of their lives. That's 4 out of 5. 80% of Americans have to deal with these issues at some point in their lives. You wouldn't get that if you listened to the Republicans in Congress, or you listened to the people who dominate the news media, or who dominate dominate just the mainstream media altogether. Those folks all make way more than most of us do, and they've never struggled. They're in the 20% who have never struggled with these issues, but 80% of Americans do. Nationwide, this study by the Associated Press found, nationwide, the number of poor people in America is at a record high of 15%, or 46.2 million. And that corresponds very closely to about the 48 million people who require food stamps. So the Republicans say that they want to do away with the food stamp program because, you know, it's being abused. But on the other hand, according to census data, collected and analyzed by the Associated Press, that figure of 48 million tracks very closely to the 46.2 million of people who are in poverty in America, and that food stamp program is completely necessary.
All right. Moving on, a verdict out this week on Bradley Manning.
Yeah, the Bradley Manning case came back with a verdict this week. For folks who don't remember who Bradley Manning is, and who would that be, I wonder? he was the Army private who turned over the cables to WikiLeaks and turned over some video from Iraq to WikiLeaks that was reposted on the internet as the collateral murder video. Bradley Manning was found this week not guilty of the biggest charge that was against him. That was of aiding the enemy, which carries a term of life without parole. In addition, if he had been found guilty of aiding the enemy, that would have been bad news, not just for future whistleblowers, but also for everyone from journalists to historians, folks who rely on information from the government in order to print newspapers and to write books, because it would have been a big catch-all. It would have been a big catch-all excuse for the government to say, okay, now we're going to classify everything that the government does, and you can no longer know anything that we do. In the Bradley Manning case, he was found not guilty of aiding the enemy, and he was also found not guilty of violating the Espionage Act by releasing the video footage of the collateral damage video, but he was found guilty of all of the other charges, including several charges of espionage. Now, the sentencing phase in his trial began on Wednesday of this week, and it's going to involve a lot more testimony, and it'll probably run for a few more weeks. The U.S. government prosecutors are asking for the maximum. That's 136 years, but we're hoping that he will not have to, which of course would be tantamount to a life sentence. We're hoping he would not have to see that much time.
All right. Also out this week, more revelations from Edward Snowden.
Yeah, the latest revelations from Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden, in case you don't remember who he is the whistleblower who has turned over information to the Guardian newspaper and the Washington Post on the NSA spying program. And there was another revelation this week. He also this week, in good news, gained immunity from Russia for a year, so he is now able to leave the facility at the Moscow airport and can now work and live in Russia for at least the next year while he tries to look for another place to take him and as a permanent resident. Now, the latest revelations in the Edward Snowden files is that the NSA has a program called X Key Score. It's NSA software that allows intelligence analysts to, and this is a direct quote, wiretap anyone from you or your accountant to a federal judge or even the president, as Edward Snowden said when he initially released this information about the NSA. He claimed this 6 weeks ago. And of course, everybody in the media and the U.S. government said, oh, that's not true. That can't be true. Blah, blah, blah. Well, X Key Score makes that absolutely true. X Key Score lets analysts fill in a simple request form that has drop-down menus to get access to its enormous database. The database covers nearly everything a typical user, quote, this is another direct quote, nearly everything a typical user does on the internet, end quote, including email contents, websites visited, online searches, social media content, including your Facebook postings, and your chats, and your instant messaging, your Skype calls, everything. No court ever reviews these. All analysts have to do, sitting in front of their computer, bring up a screen, fill in click on a few drop-down boxes, and they're given access to whatever data they want on whoever they want. Now, this is exactly what I talked about 5 or 6 weeks ago when this stuff first broke, is that I wouldn't be surprised if the NSA just had a pile of forms sitting on a table somewhere, and all the analysts had to do was reach over, grab a form, put it right in a name, put it in a file, and they can just go ahead and tap anybody. Well, this is that same thing, only it's paperless.
Yeah, it's actually even easier.
It's even easier.
It's just a click away.
Just click on a drop down list, and you have your reason for wiretapping someone, and it gives you the go ahead. No court review necessary. So I found this not only shocking, but just kind of head slappingly wrong.
All right. Finally, a study out on honeybees.
Yeah, this was actually the week before last that this study came out on the online journal PLOS-1. It was a study looking at crop pollination and pesticide exposures to honeybees. And what it looked at, they collected pollen from several test hives. They were looking at how many types of pesticides and the total pesticide load in pollen in honeybee hives to try to figure out what might be the cause of colony collapse disorder. They looked at the three main types of pesticides, which are insecticides that target insects, fungicides, which target fungal crop infestations, and herbicides, which target weeds. What they found is that most of the pollen, and what they said too in the study is that most studies only look at insecticides and how they impact bees. Most studies never even look at whether fungicides and herbicides have any effect on honeybees. And what they did is they looked at what was in the pollen and what had the worst effects. They found an average in each pollen sample, they found an average of 9 different pesticides in each sample. The sample with the highest number of pesticides had 21 different chemicals in the pollen. Surprisingly, they found that fungicides, in particular two fungicides, appeared to have the worst impact on the bees versus the insecticides and the herbicides. Fungicides are almost never studied for their impact on honeybees. They also found that two pesticides used by beekeepers to kill the varroa mite, which is a honeybee parasite, tended to have very bad effects on the honeybees themselves. Those two pesticides are DMPF and fluvalinate. Finally, what they found is that most of these chemicals didn't come from the crops themselves. They came from wildflower pollen. This shows that farmers need to manage the chemical drift from their fields when they spray for insects and weeds and funguses. This chemical drift means an accumulation of not just one or two, but of up to 21 different pesticides in wildflower populations, and that itself could be what is undermining the health of honeybee colonies.
And just a reminder, one out of every three bites that goes into our mouth is brought to you by honeybees. So,
yeah.
Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomchuk with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
People can find Eat the State online at www.eatthestate.org.